Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, March the 5th, 2026, and since it's a Thursday, it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I got a big lineup for you today as we kick off with episode 3,811 of the Survival Podcast. Well, Chris Rossini was gone for a couple weeks on vacation. He's back, so we've got Ron Paul's Liberty Highlight for the week back as our lead-off, as we usually do. And we have a segment on the Trump administration lying on Iran and falling flat. When I read the title of that, I really thought I was going to have some disagreement, and I don't. I don't have any. I thought... Well, I'll explain after when we get to theirs. Andy McCann will talk about dealing with joint pain. Mike Melito will talk about bullpup carbines. It's kind of a critique, really, too. Like, is it really worth it? He left one thing out that I'll close the gap on at the end. Kerry Brown will answer a question about something called a catkin. Hey, you either know what that is, you're like, a what? Cat? What? Would I pet the cat? No, it's nothing to do with a cat. But specifically hazelnut catkins, and some of you that were on the fence of what that meant just figured it out. But did you know you'll find out. Matt Sersley will talk about selling a business and trying to reduce the capital gains tax when you sell that business. Ken Daniels will talk about switching over to cast iron, and is it worth it to go around milling down cast iron? Then Joel Riles will talk about fixing the behavior in a puppy who is pawing and jumping up and getting that done before they get big and they cause more problems with the pawing, the jumping up. And to me, the biggest issue with this is generally people that have kids that when that dog jumps up and paws, that kid's short enough that they're getting pawed in the face. That's a bigger issue than getting scratched on the arms and stuff. Joel's got great advice on that. And then I'm going to talk about the new growth trend in homesteading that I expect to see. I have no proof this is about to happen, but every bit of my Spirko sense, right, my Spirko Spidey sense, tells me that we have a new boom coming to homesteading. And it probably ain't what you think. It's not, and I'm not saying there's going to be any negative impact on the people that are out on, 5 acres, 50 acres, et cetera, raising sheep and all that. I think we're about to experience a new boom in what you'd call urban homesteading, but I really like referring to it as suburban homesteading. Urban to me means you're in the city center. Urban is not suburbs. Urban is generally not the larger lots that most suburbs have, because some of the things they're doing now with suburban building are just dumb. But most suburban lots have at least like 0.15, 0.2 acres total. Some of them are considerably larger. A 0.3 acre lot is fairly large in the suburban mode now. But there are a lot of homes out there, edging toward an acre, or they are perhaps 0.75 acre. There's a lot that can be done with that. And I think we're about to see real uptick in that demographic, or I should say in that space. Very, very soon, and I'll explain why when we get to my segment. Before we do that, though, I do want to remind you guys that every week I put out somewhere between 2 and 5 items as items of the day. This week, because of some things that went on with a very long show with Nick Ferguson yesterday, a very long show with John and Nicole on Tuesday, I only did 2. But the 2 items of the day this week were first the Olatin's T058 folding titanium scalpel. That thing speaks for itself. It's like a little mini liner lock pocket knife, and it uses the largest standard surgical blade. It's just under 3 inches that comes in at like a standard surgical blade, so you can keep the economy of cost down and replacing those blades. It's just an awesome tool. Again, it's the whole body is titanium, including the spring, the liner lock spring, so it's going to last a very, very long time, and it's very affordable, and it is extremely affordable to replace blades on. And I'd recommend you check the write-up on it on the site. And the other are the nursery trays with the 3-inch pots that I brought to you guys yesterday at the end of that very long show. If you didn't catch that show, you want to check these out. I want to say a bunch of them about them today on audio, but I'm just going to say they have become my go-to. And I have had incredible results this year with my seed starting. But the seed started just as well last year when I was also using 3-inch pots without these particular trays. But the management, moving them in and out of racks, watering them, moving them around, swapping out, like you got a couple really low plants and you want them under the closer light, so you do some swap outs without having like 6-packs, making you have to do them all at once and what have you. They've been fantastic. If you've watched any of my update videos on the aquaponics and seed starting system out in the garage, you've seen the results of that just from the plants themselves. I've never been this happy with my results and the work necessary to achieve them as with this setup of these trays and these pots put together. So check them out, and they are very, very affordable. And you're running out of time. If you're the person that puts, you know, seeds in pots, this is about the edge of how far out in the year you need to be doing that. So get on with it, right? All right, so with that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on the Trump administration's lies in Iran falling flat.
As each day passes, each justification that the Trump administration puts out are debunked. The idea that Iran was just 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon, completely false. Even the IAEA, which is hardly on the side of Iran, has said this is not the case. There's no indication they were doing that. The other claim justification is that Iran was about to strike. That's what President Trump said. At the same time, his Secretary of State was saying, well, actually, Israel was ready to strike, and we knew that we would get hit if Israel struck, so we had to strike first. On and on it goes. Everything they're trying to throw out there is not sticking because it's a blatant lie. And it looks more and more like the lies that were meant to get us into Iraq. And the result appears to be becoming the same, which is us getting bogged down into something that the neocons promised the president. Back then it was George W. Bush. Now it's President Trump. Promised him it would be a cakewalk. This will be just like Venezuela. In and out. Big boom. Everyone's going to talk about how wonderful you are. Just give us the thumbs up and we'll do it. Well, it's not working that way. Just adding to the confusion and saying things that are so blatantly false that it's hard to take him seriously. Let's listen to Johnson here.
Iran has attacked 3 of our U.S. embassies in the last couple of days. Okay, those are sovereign territories of the U.S. They have declared war on us. I don't believe in the semantics. We've talked about the language this morning. We're not at war right now. We're 4 days in to a very specific, clear mission, an operation, Operation Epic Fury, which has 2 components, as you know, that we have articulated over and over. The president has, the commander of joint chiefs, everybody has explained.
They declared war on us. Well, what happened prior to that, Speaker Johnson? We bombed them, right? And then he says, we're not at war. We're not at war.
You know, these types of war, almost all wars, end in exhaustion. You know, there's too much killing. People finally get fed up. Too many problems at home. All kinds of complications. And I think this article indicates that maybe they're going to get closer to this. And this says the U.S. is loses nearly $2 billion worth of military equipment in the first 4 days.
Yeah.
How long can we do that? Well, as long as they'll take our dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can't believe people keep taking the dollars, but it must be that the other currencies are so bad.
Yeah, so much worse.
And we have a military that up until now there was no question in their ability. But now we're reading some questions where maybe the military is not as strong as it used to be. And I think what's going to happen is maybe the cost of groceries at the store is going to play a part. And when the American people get fed up with this.
Well, absolutely. You know, I always look at the gas prices. Before the war started, it was $2.19 a gallon down here in Lake Jackson. I just drove by the Buc-ee's on the way to the studio. It's $2.89. So that's a big I'm glad you brought up cost because that's really important. It's something that's not being discussed.
Like I said, I really don't have anything to disagree with there other than I sort of maybe just less than disagree, more object to the connotation at the end by Dr. Paul there that – you know, it's going to be a long, forever war. I don't think there's any plans by the United States to do that. And until there is one boot on the ground inside of Iran, that is not a thing. That is not a thing. Whether you think we should have done this or not, what I can tell you is we've massively degraded the power center in Iran in every way. Power over people, power over region, and power to make war and use weapons at their discretion. The whole, you know, they declared war on us thing. You know, there's the people saying that, what they're really saying, if you actually listen to more than just the headline, is that Iran has been at war with us since 1979. Some people feel that way, some people don't. From a standpoint of what it means to say that, though, no. No, that again, that's another lie. The reason I thought I would have some more objection to this is the way the subject read when Chris sent it over to me. I thought they were going to start making the case that, you know, really the U.S. doesn't have the capability to do this. Some of the cases the special people are making online right now. I read an article yesterday claiming we're going to run out of ammunition. These are the same people that told you Russia was literally running out of bullets 4 years ago in the Ukraine conflict. These people do not need to be listened to. The military capability being unleashed right now is frightening, and it's also incredibly accurate and incredibly effective. And the whole, you know, Iran is just going to keep sending, you know, thousands and thousands of these drones and rockets and missiles every day. That's not happening, and their ability to do that continues to decline. Now, what is the end of this? My huge doubt, and I think I covered that this week in full, but I'll just restate it here in case you didn't get the earlier show, is I think that the world and the governments of the world and the Western governments of the world and the United States in particular are highly overestimating the desire of the average Iranian citizen to overthrow their government. I don't think it's there. I think Iran is extremely nationalistic and patriotic, and I think there's a lot of people in Iran that do not like their government, but that doesn't mean that they're willing to overthrow it. Those are two different things. Many of us do not like our government. It doesn't mean that we're willing to overthrow it, and it doesn't mean that if somebody came in here and started lobbing bombs at us, that we'd be like, oh, hey, look, let's go overthrow our government. And I think one of the problems that we have, especially as Americans, is we think everybody wants things the way we want things. Hell, we don't all want things the way we want them in America, right? Let alone a country that has been under this Islamic rule since 79, meaning that almost everybody, that's going to take anybody that's about a little bit younger than me, so 50 or younger, either never knew another way or they were so young when it was a different way that it's erased. And so with that being the case, the people that are in charge, the people that have power, they were either people that wanted it that way in the first place. That's why the only way you're still in power at 60 or 70 or 80 is you're like an OG, right? Your original Islamic gangster, right? So those people aren't going to turn. And then these younger people don't know another way. And it is a religious idealism. And one of the things we had a discussion with John and Nicole this week was the categories that are the things, the causal factors of civilization collapse. And I went through 11 of them that are in this book that we're reading. And I just glossed over, I think one's missing. And that is the unification by a common ideal. And the most powerful common ideal that unifies a civilization, a nation state, is religious. And I think we're way underestimating that. So this idea that we can just pop a few bombs off here and there, degrade their ability, I may be over-optimistic. The other side of it, though, is people are people. Ambition is ambition. And you just wonder if they keep taking the head off the snake over, and the head keeps regrowing from the lower, you know, basically from the body, from someone below it. If there isn't a point where a group get together, and it really doesn't look like a coup, but it kind of is, where they kind of go like, okay, we're the new council, and they reach out to the United States and go, oh, please, stop, don't, wait, look, we'll make a deal. And that deal not being made to appease the United States, but being an opportunistic deal, hey, we could be in charge. We can give just a few concessions, and people, because you're getting to a level now where you've gone down that line of succession enough with wiping people out, people that never thought they would ever be in charge at that high of a level are kind of sitting there as the next one after the next slice of the head. And at some point you think, well, I could either risk getting bombed and killed playing the long game for my ideology, or I can cut the deal. And as I said Tuesday, if that deal is as much as we absolutely swear off of nuclear weapons, yes, you can come check to make sure we're not making nuclear weapons, and we'll give just a little bit more human rights, and we'll sign an agreement to not attack our neighbors, and we'll be good little boys, then you get what looks like a huge victory for the United States. And I think that's possible, but possible doesn't mean probable. With that, let's talk about something more more directly involved in our lives and our area of control, and that is joint pain. And joint pain is something that as we age, we get more and more familiar with, and sometimes it's arthritis, but sometimes it's other things as well. I'll have a few thoughts on this one after Andy's done with it.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage and a couple other businesses. Some do good, some don't exist anymore, I guess. Anyway, I've got an email here from Jerry, and Jerry has a joint question. The question is, what can you recommend for aching joints? Okay, then he goes on to give a super awesome detailed explanation of everything. And you guys know that reading out loud is my kryptonite, so I'm not going to read this. I am going to summarize it, but Jerry, thank you for so much details, and I got a lot of thoughts on this. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you my – I get 7 minutes to talk to you about this, so I'm going to give it to you. And I'm going to turn this into a full episode on my podcast. It's Fitness, Food, and Finance. It'll be episode 254. And just because I have a lot of ideas and thoughts on this, especially with the details that you give. But I'm going to give you the first quick and easy – this is what's going on. Okay, so the background is, hey, I'm 64 – 5'10 and 165. So right there, that's some great dimensions. He also says that he's in good health and has no lifetime med. So right there, you're already winning. He goes on to say he had a very hands-on type of career and then moved on into a desk job after getting an engineering degree where he sat a whole bunch. So that becomes an issue. So the biggest thing is he is trying to move, but his joints are aching. He's tried some remedies like turmeric and other supplements, also some edibles, and that's sort of okay. So right there, I would say some of that is masking, not solving the problem. So while I'm not against doing that stuff, I would try other things first probably. Now, you also mentioned that you're trying to eat more meat, but you do a lot of carbs and sugar. So I'm going to throw out this one. Carbs and sugar are highly inflammatory. It could just be that that food isn't good for you. So what I would first recommendation that is really easy is track your food for 2 weeks. Give me an email and I'll review it with you for free. Or better would be to hire one of my coaches like Coach Josiah, which specializes in this sort of stuff as well as nutrition. So he's a personal trainer as well as a coach for me, focusing on athletic and joints. So this would be right up his alley. So I would probably hire him or someone local for like 2 or 3 months. They're going to give you a lot of good information on your food that you can then take with you for the rest of your life. So first would be to hire one of those guys to give you some specifics or track it for me and let me know, and we can look at that together. But yeah, right now I'm going to say that if you're a sugar fiend, then yeah, that's probably a good portion of it. But also at 64, dog, hey, you're crushing it. All right, so the couple things. Your joints want to be compressed and decompressed is going to create blood flow in there. Blood that's flowing in there is going to create healing. So yes, you want to keep moving. Now, you said you do lighter weights but higher reps. I would change that and say, okay, that's hurting a bit and not feeling good. This is where some of the pain is, but sitting around and doing nothing is worse. That's correct. I would focus on your range of motion. So look up like how to actually do a deep squat. Look up the range of motion for the different movements that you want, a full range of motion. And I would do those, and I would do it as some tempo lifts. So instead of doing 30 reps of whatever it is, let's say you're doing a thruster. Instead of doing 30 thrusters, I would do 15 thrusters, and then I would edit the type of tempo that I'm doing. So maybe on Monday, you're doing thrusters or whatever movement, and you're doing a just super slow. The whole thing up and down is slow. So maybe you have a 3 second down and a 3 second up. Then Tuesday, I would do a 3 second down and explode up. I mean, obviously don't do anything stupid. Don't like jump your knees out of socket. But you see what I'm saying is you're changing up the tempo. And then maybe Wednesday, do a faster down and a slow up. So you can change the way it feels, the time under tension, and give your joints that compression without overstimulating them. So I think that would be a way to go, is change or add in some tempo. And maybe some days go long and strong, but don't always do that. Something else that you can try that is, I've seen success with it in some folks, is a rebounder. So it's basically a very small trampoline. Actually, I'll link you one on Amazon. Well, I'll link it to Jack, and Jack can link it back over to you. But I know you can't see it, but it looks like this. It's just a very small trampoline that you do light bounces on. And I would bounce, like, it's good for lymph nodes and other stuff, but it creates that compression. And there's just not as much pounding, like, if you're out jogging and stuff. It's small circle, maybe, like, I don't know, 4 foot in diameter. And anyway, they're about $50, so I'll link that over to you. Another thing you can try, again, along with all of the eating, I do like that, but until you clean up the sugar, it's not really going to move the needle. You need to get rid of some of the inflammatories first. I know a guy who used these patches my wife is into that would, he put it on his knee and regrew meniscus. Now, is it a one-off? Maybe. Is it for real? He says it is, so if you're interested in that, let me know. I'll connect you over to my wife, Verity, and she can work with you on that. Okay. Let me also just end with this. You're doing everything right. You're a 64, and your body dimensions are great. You're moving. You're having fun. It looks like you're enjoying life. I can tell by the email that you wrote that you love this stuff. That's great. As an engineer, dive into it. How do you fix it? Hey, easiest way is to ask somebody who knows. I've been there. I'm working on an ankle and a knee myself. I like following this guy, the knees over toe guy. Now, he's more into the MCL, ACL tears. And mine's a torn meniscus, so it's not really the same thing. But the idea is the same, some hypermobilization. So it's a good idea. Another thing you could do, go down is the red light therapy. I had a question about this a while ago. Some say that's good on joints. I have tried everything my wife has been into with these red lights and different wavelengths. Pretty much nothing works on me the way I've seen it work on her. Now, I will say that I've seen, like, carnivore work really well. So you could go down that route. My son cured his Crohn's diagnosis with the lion diet. So maybe that's a thing. So you kind of have to decide, maybe this is the biggest picture of all, or biggest decision is, am I solving for my tongue who likes to be an asshole and eat sugar? Or am I solving for all this joint pain? So if you're really into the joint pain, it may mean you have to give up that sugar. All right, guys. Hey, this is Andy McCann. I will fluff this one up on episode 254. Y'all take care.
Now, one thing Andy sent me was a link to a folding trampoline that has a smart workout app that goes with it. He mentioned that. That link is there. I just want to give a piece of advice on those bouncy trampolines, and I don't care if it's this one or any of them, including one that's already in your house, if it's part of your fitness regimen. My wife has one. I highly recommend that the legs on all of them work the same. They basically have a frame. The frame has a female fitting in it. And then there is a male fitting screw bolt, whatever you want to call it, at the end of the leg, and you just turn it in by hand. And they say you don't need any tools, and that's true. And you can put it together, and it will work just fine. But what will happen inevitably with anything that experiences bouncing and stress is that it will begin to loosen. And I highly recommend, if you're going to use one of these, that you put a little bit of the removable type of Loctite on it. Screw it in with your hands, and then get a good pair of, like, channel locks, or if you're like me and you use Knipex pipe pliers, they're even better, but something like that, you can get a grip on it, and you don't need to Rambo, like, a whole turn out of it, but take it to where it's tight to your hand, and maybe give it about close to a quarter turn more. And if you do that, you will not have them loosen up because they can be kind of dangerous when that happens. It's happened to my wife a couple times, and the end of that shit, and that's what I did, and it's worked fine ever since. That's my one add on there. And then on joint pain, you know, when you first start doing things that you haven't been doing, you're going to have pain, and Andy's right, you have to work through it slowly, but don't let that initial discomfort stop you, because a lot of times your body will adapt to it. There's a big difference between, I've never been physically active, and I started in a fitness routine, and now I ache. Then you weren't doing anything and you just started aching. And the one other thing I'll add to it, and I'm not going to dig into it, but diet. So much of these inflamed joints and other inflammation issues go directly to our diet. And, you know, obviously Andy's going to say carnivore is kind of the best way to go. I'm going to tell you more of a keto approach, but a Whole 30, a Primal, anything that eliminates all of the seed oils and minimizes refined carbohydrates and cuts carbs a little, even a little bit. Like I said, If your allowance is 100 carbs a day, and I don't mean any games or any gimmicky food or any, you know, zero net carbs, 100 carbs a day, you're ahead of about 90% of America in the way that you're living. Again, seed oils and everything else. And you might find a lot of disinflammation. And red ruminant meat is one of the most disinflammatory foods you can eat, even if you're not going full-on carnivore, lion diet, that kind of thing. All right, moving on. Let's talk about bull pups with Mike Melito.
What is going on, TSP? Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast to answer your questions on gun and gun-related topics. Well, it had to come up eventually. Bull pups. Is a bull pup worth it? Short answer, no. Long answer, no, and here's why. So, I've been around bull pups. I have done quite a bit of private security contract work. Got a lot of guys under me. I've made it a point to hire from different backgrounds when I was the commander of such units. And I hired quite a few IDF guys, Israeli Defense Force. Now, whatever you think about the geopolitics of the nation state of Israel is not germane to this topic. But the IDF, they know their way around a ground fight. They use, in part, of all the bullpups, what I consider is the best bullpup. And that's the Tavor. It's probably the most battle-proven bullpup on the planet. And it's decent. I'm familiar with them. Even those IDF guys, I don't know any of them that prefer them over just a run-of-the-mill M4 AR. They use those as well, just to establish some bona fides. Now let's get into why the bullpup. There is a distinct advantage in a bullpup. Distinct advantage is you get a longer barrel and a shorter overall package. With most traditional firearms, forgive me if I'm mansplaining here, but not everybody knows this stuff, you have your stock and then you have your receiver where generally everything comes together. The barrel, the bolt, the magazine. And that's generally in the middle. In a bullpup, you slide that whole apparatus back so it's next to your face. Pretty much all that stuff, the receiver and everything, is in the stock, if you want to think of it that way. Which gives you a much longer barrel for the same overall length. That is the advantage of a bullpup. And that is a real advantage. Get a longer barrel and a similar overall package. You might get a 16-inch overall barrel, what traditionally would be an 11 or 12-inch barrel, overall length of the firearm. Or you might get a 20-inch and something similar to a 14-inch carbine or something like that. So there is a real advantage there. Now, for the disadvantages, and there are a plethora. The big one being they are completely different in handling than every other pretty much gun you've ever shot. The point of balance is different. The reloads are quite different. Also have that explosion going off next to your face instead of out in front of your face. Because of that, they tend to be quite heavy. If you look at the weight of something like a Tavor, it may be small overall in length, but it's heavy. It's quite a bit heavier than similar length AR-15. Also, they can be quite a pain to clear malfunctions in. They tend to be pretty closed off actions. That's not always the case, but in general. So every other thing is different. If I could use an analogy, I was about to use a stick shift analogy. I realize many people probably don't know how to drive a stick shift nowadays. I'm going to use it anyway. Imagine you're familiar with a stick shift. Even if you're not, you know how to drive a stick shift. You know, generally they're laid out the same first, second, third, fourth, fifth gear and reverse. Imagine if you just one day hopped in a vehicle and you had to drive it under stress, like somebody was shooting at you, and the pattern was completely the opposite on the stick shift, or a completely different pattern. Like you went up for first gear, and then you went completely all the way over, and then all the way down for second gear, and you had to come all the way back for third gear. Something like that, right? You could probably do it and get really good at it, but you have to really marry that system. That's what I think about bullpups. If you are going to run one, you had better marry it and train with it a lot. Pretty much make that your go-to platform, because it's completely different in operation, in reloading, in malfunction clearing, in balance, in your shooting technique. All that is going to be different. And you're doing all that for that one advantage of a few extra inches of barrel. So I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze. So that's your long answer, no. Now, to go to the listener's more specific question, is a bullpup worth it? I'm looking at getting a truck gun, probably, and probably it's either an AR or an AK pistol or a bullpup. Yes, either one of those would likely be better. Now, I've used both ARs and AKs. Use them both in theater. I like the AK. The AK is a phenomenal platform. Now, this shouldn't be the case because guns are objects. And guns are neither good or bad. They're not malamente. They're not evil by nature. An AK is not evil because it was made by communists. It just is. And it's a fine weapon. It's a fine platform. And it's got a lot of advantages. But here in America, more likely, whether you think it's right or wrong, it is. We live in the world that is. It's more likely to get you seen as the bad guy. And that just is. If it's for a serious use gun, which I would consider like a truck gun, a serious use gun, you're going to have to whip that thing out in a hurry. Certain, in the type of situations you may have to whip it out in, being seen as, perceived as the bad guy is probably not good. Now, if that's not important to you, then you choose either one. They both have their advantages. I could go on for hours and hours and hours about the pros and cons of 5.56 versus 7.62x39, or, you know, a gas piston system versus a direct impingement system. And I'm not the biggest fan of ARs. They have their weaknesses, right? But still, in America, in 2026, the AR is the one to beat. You know, a decade ago, the market was flooded with really decent, affordable AKs. Or AK clones, right? Because you're talking full auto, it's not a real AK. But anyway, that's not the case anymore. The ammunition is not cheap anymore like it used to be when you could just get spam cans. Dirt cheap, and the guns aren't dirt cheap. You're not getting a decent AK anymore. You just happen upon one and somebody doesn't know what they have for $300 or $400. The entry level ones are $600-$700 for like a PSA bare bones AK and like $1,000 for a medium grade one. You can get really, really good ARs for that. And there are advantages to 7.62x39. I think if I'm being honest, it's probably the best intermediate rifle cartridge, period. But in America, 5.56 is cheaper. 223 is cheaper. What makes you good at shooting is actually shooting. You're going to be able to shoot more for the same money. So, if I'm giving you a recommendation, get a good, solid AR-15 M4 Jury, M4 clone of decent make that you've trained with and you practice with. If you want to get an AK, that's great. They're good platforms, too. They have their advantages. But kind of the AR is the one to beat. I know it's boring. I know everybody has one, but that's for a reason. It's the standard for a reason. So those are my thoughts on bullpups and your question in general. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Jack. Keep the questions coming and have a blessed day.
My only add-on to that one, and I kept expecting him to say it, I don't think most people that buy a bullpup are really looking for the performance of the long barrel in a shorter format. I think what they're looking for is the shortest overall length possible. And because the specification on what makes a rifle an SBR has really two things going on, the overall length of the weapon and the length of the barrel, both are at play. There's some room to get the overall length down versus the barrel with that bullpup design. So now we've got a shorter weapon, but I don't have to get an SBR, stamp for it, a tax stamp, about $200. I'm going to tell you, most of the bullpups that are out there cost enough money you could afford the stamp. And I know some people just don't want another piece of paper from the government with their name on it. I get that. But most of you would have no problem, and the total cost would still be less with like an AR SBR with like an 11 or 12-inch barrel on it. It's lighter, it's faster, it's more maneuverable. You got to get the stamp, but that's what I would do. I'm not going to look for that bullpup to be a loophole because it's not sufficient in performance from a standpoint of what the purpose of such a weapon is for the detriments that he mentioned, which weight is a big one of them. That said, I have a little Walther 22 that I got from my buddy David. It's a bullpup, and I love it. But there's a big difference in a 22 long rifle is to additional weight versus something like a 223 or, you know, depending on what you're doing. They get fairly heavy, and they don't, it's not they don't function. They don't operate in a way that most people are accustomed to. There's a little bit of difference in the ergonomics, and I would rather be good with the weapon as best as possible with the weapon, then try to save $200 on a tax stamp and not want a permit. I don't do any of you guys know me. I don't think we should have that permit, but it is what it is. All right, next up, we're going to hear about Hazelnut Catkins with Carrie Brown.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie here from Strong Roots Resources. And a couple of days ago, I was out on a customer's property who has multiple relatively mature hazelnut shrubs. And this time of year, they are covered in catkins. Catkins are the male flowers. They contain pollen, and they're pretty much how, with the assistance of the wind, they are pretty much how these hazelnuts are pollinated. So these are kind of these tubular, elongated, like I said, male flowers, and me, being who I am, looked at those and went, are those edible? So I did a real quick search while I was there, and the answer is yes. So when I got home, I dug in a little bit deeper with some of my books, and hazelnut catkins are actually an old school, late winter, relatively high nutrient density food source. So we'll take it from the top here. Like I was saying, these are the dangling male flowers that you see hanging off the shrub in late winter. They are one of the earliest pollen sources in the landscape. And people tend to overlook them, especially these days, because they look ornamental. But they've been used traditionally as a food, as a seasonal wild food and medicine. So I think of them as a short seasonal window food. They're pretty mild, slightly nutty, sometimes bitter, but they're really pollen heavy. So there's kind of like a window in which these are good, and then as it becomes more kind of densely covered in pollen, they get less palatable. So the best timing to harvest these is late winter to very early spring, just as they're beginning to shed pollen. That's when they're fully elongated, they're bright yellow, they're soft and flexible, and they're not dried out, and they haven't really turned brown yet. If you wait too long, they just become dusty and harsh, and too early, they're kind of tough and just underdeveloped. So if you pinch one as a test, pinch one, and if it compresses easily and smells fresh and green, that's prime. So that's for us in East Tennessee right about now, here in, I guess we're in the second week of February. So since they are when pollinated, and those male flowers are responsible for nut production later in the year, you don't want to strip a shrub aggressively. You only want to take about 10 or 20% from any one plant, and if you have multiple shrubs, you want to spread your harvest across those. But they are abundant, so you don't need much, and a handful is plenty for most uses. You can eat them fresh in the field. Their texture is soft and fluffy. It's kind of like a plant protein dust, if you've ever used plant proteins to mix in with smoothies or whatever. You can certainly use them in that manner. Some people love them. I think they're pretty good. Some people think they taste like pollen, and they regret that decision. So try a small amount before you harvest a whole bunch of it. And if you have seasonal allergies, you might want to take extra care here, because you are literally eating pollen, so be aware of that. Dried and powdered is the most traditional approach. You can dry them gently, spread them out on a screen or a tray in a warm, dry place out of direct sun, and just wait a few days until they're crisp. Then you just kind of grind them up into a powder. Folks use them to add to flour for bread or pancakes. You can store it into something like your oatmeal or something like that, mix it into smoothies, put it in a protein boost, put it in trail mixes as a protein boost. You can thicken soups. They're loaded with omega-3s, amino acids, protein, trace minerals. Pretty useful food right out there. And they were valued as an early spring nourishment when winter stores were starting to run low. If you want to try cooking them, you can saute them or toast them briefly in a dry pan, low heat, 1 to 2 minutes, just until they start to become fragrant. And cooking will reduce that bitterness and mellows the intensity of the pollen. Quite a few medicinal folk uses as well. Hazel catkins are, within the European folk tradition, a tonic for late winter fatigue, which Lord knows many of us could use a hand with that, does have some mild anti-inflammatory aspects. It is an astringent herb and can be used for seasonal immune support. I throw these in the teas as well. I've started doing that since I discovered how useful they are. Your modern herbalists mostly view this as a nutritious wild food rather than a strong medicine, more along the lines of nourishment, not trying to actually address specific issues. And of course, if you see these on the roadside, consider skipping them. They're probably going to have quite a bit of dust, heavy metal contamination, sprayed landscapes. Watch out for allergy sensitivity, and just go easy your first time, because they are relatively safe as far as forage things go, but the concentrated pollen is pretty active. So also, certainly take care if you do have a tree nut allergy. That could certainly kick off a response there. So that's what I got for you today. We're talking about the catkins on hazelnut shrubs. Hope this is useful to you guys, and we will talk to you next time.
I love stuff like this for a variety of reasons. One, finding out you have a food resource in your backyard you didn't know was a food resource, even if it's short-term seasonal, is a cool thing. Another thing is, a foodie, I like actually things like this. Like, I'm a few weeks away from all my black locusts putting all those beautiful white flowers on, and then I get about 2 to 3 weeks where we can use those. And I just kind of like and dig that as well. Where these things, though, because they can be made into a powder, could be a more long-term resource, even though they're a short-term opportunity for harvest. But the big thing I like about this is it gives us more and more insight into our forebears, our ancestors, those who came before us, and not even, you know, just going back. This is very much northeastern United States. There's a lot of people post-colonial that use this as traditional food and medicine both. But I'll guarantee you, go back, like, this is something the tribes of North America were keenly aware of, that this was a food source. And so you're going back thousands of years, probably, of this being used. As soon as somebody figured out, hey, that little puffy thing you needed doesn't kill you. And then figured out that it had benefit, especially at a time of the year where there's not that much to forage yet. This is when our wild leeks are just popping up and stuff like that, and maybe you're starting to see maybe some fiddlehead that's not even coming up yet, but yet these things are out. So those early first resources were heavily relied upon to bridge that gap between what you were able to store and hunt and develop as resource for the larder during your winter, and then transitioning into spring abundance. There's that lean period in there, and so that is something that it's always interesting to me. What were the things, you know? And then the other thing is, you know, I always try to explain when I talk about diet and nutrition. One of the reasons I'm not a purist the way some people in the keto or carnivore space are, is I do think a traditional diet for humans is what we should be striving for. And I think that traditional diet is highly varied based on region. So you would obviously not be eating hazelnut catkins in early spring, late winter if you lived in Florida or Central America or sub-Saharan Africa. And if you live somewhere on a creek where there's a lot of shellfish before everything was polluted, you would probably be eating a lot of shellfish because they're right there and they can't run away and they're highly nutritious and they grow back. Right? And if you live somewhere where there was a lot of fish, you'd eat a lot of fish. And if you lived in a place where there were big, giant ruminants, you'd eat that. And the reason I think, though, that sticking to the low-carb side of thing makes sense when you track it that way is you don't find high carbohydrate outside of cultivated crops except in very few areas, very few exceptions, and generally seasonally controlled. About the only thing that breaks that is figs in the tropics. You get these giant, massive fig trees. You can't even get your head around how big they grow. Five people linking hands, not being able to reach around the trunk. And you can get in some places where there's a tremendous amount of sugar available in the canopy and other fruits, tropical fruits. But outside of the tropics, they don't exist. They just don't. And having any real significant source of carbohydrate and fat at the same time, unusual. And so when we look at things like this, we get a better understanding of what a correct for species diet for humans looks like. So I like that as well. But thanks for that segment, Kerry. I had no idea. That's one of those questions you don't know to ask, so how do you ask it? Well, you have to have somebody that cares enough to find the question for you like Kerry does. Next up, we're going to hear from Matt Sersley on minimizing capital gains tax.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley of Agris Tax Advice. I know it's been a little while. It's been under the weather for a while, but I am back here today to answer another listener question. I am going to be selling one of my businesses. What can I do to reduce capital gains tax? More information. I have a bagel shop that I've owned for 4 years. I'm getting ready to sell it. I currently rent the location it's in. I own all of the equipment and inventory. There's no debt on the business. What ways can I shelter or invest the profits to help me reduce the capital gains tax? Well, I'm going to give you an answer today, but I'm going to start with the really annoying truth. To really answer this question, I need way more information about how you're structured, how you're taxed, and where you're located. If you're a sole proprietor or an LLC or an S corp or a C corp, these answers are going to be different. And if you're in New York City, we're going to do it different than if you're in Miami, and different probably if you're in, say, Chicago. But I can at least talk about some of the big levers to move the needle. And here's the thing. The IRS wants your sale to be the payday, and you want a strategy to avoid that. Now, one other thing. You said you want to avoid capital gains, but actually, when you sell a business, it depends on how you sell it for if it's taxed. If it's in an LLC or a corporation, and you sell the shares, it's a capital gain. But very often, it's what's called an asset sale, where they just buy your inventory, your equipment, your name, your goodwill, but they don't take your LLC. And when that happens, some of that gets taxed as ordinary income. Some of it can be taxed as depreciation recapture, which is the exact same income tax rate as ordinary income. And some of it is capital gains treatment. So step one isn't even what can I invest in to avoid this. Step one is we need to allocate the price across the different buckets. And while there are 7 different buckets, typically you're looking at 3. Inventory, ordinary income. Equipment, any depreciation you've taken, you pay recapture, which is ordinary income. Goodwill, capital gains treatment. You've held this for long enough, you're in long-term capital gains land, so goodwill is going to save you money on your taxes, but you and the buyer will have to agree how to split the payments into these different categories. And the buyer is going to want it to be as much inventory and equipment as possible and as little goodwill as possible. So you need to make sure that you are agreeing with this on your LOI, your contracts, etc., to make sure you're getting the best tax treatment possible. Now, first big thing you can do it as an installment sale. If you don't need all the cash, and if you trust the person to pay you or if they have assets, don't take all the money in the first year necessarily. Now, all of the inventory and equipment, you owe tax on that in the first year, whether you get the money or not. So make sure you get enough money to pay that tax. I've seen these deals fall apart over that. But if you spread out that capital gains, sometimes you can get much better tax treatment. Now, sometimes it's worse tax treatment. Sometimes it really is better to just get it over with right now. But that's something to consider. The next big lever I would look at for you is what's called a charitable remainder trust. This is a really advanced thing. It's really easy to screw this up. You need a CPA or an attorney to help you with this. It's a little bit complicated. Basically, you take your business or the assets of your business and you put it in a trust. And while you're alive and while your spouse is alive, you're allowed to use the money you make from the sale to invest, et cetera, to take that out and to live on it. When you and your spouse die, all of the money in that trust will go to charity. So you are going to lose it. The benefit is this would completely avoid tax on this entirely because legally you gave the whole thing to charity. And again, the thing that makes this kind of nice is, let's say it's, $1 million. Well, you now have $1 million you can invest and earn money for and take that out while you're alive. and you don't pay the capital gains tax and the ordinary income tax on that $1 million. The fourth level is the one that's the most exciting, and it's one you can't do based on what you've told me. But this is one of the holy grails of tax law, no tax at all. So the problem is you have to, well, and they change this in One Big Beautiful Bill. To use this, you have to have a C corp, and you have to have held the stock in the C corp for at least 5 years. But then when you sell that business, the first, I believe it's $10 million of gain is income tax free for you. They made this a little bit better in the One Big Beautiful Bill, where if you don't make it 5 years, but you make it 3 or 4 years, you get some of the benefits. But unfortunately, it's not retroactive. It only applies if you got the stock in 2025 or later. Since you said you own this for only 4 years, I assume this does not qualify, especially if you are a C corp, and you're probably not. This would be a reason to maybe delay the sale, especially if it's not 4 years, but it's 4 years and 10 months. Waiting that extra 2 months could make the whole thing tax-free. Now, here's the don't screw up section. Don't wait until you signed a deal to start planning. Once you sign that contract, a lot of what your options are gone, including it's even too late to do the charitable remainder trust, because the contract's got to be between the trust selling those assets to him instead of with you. Same thing on the installment sale, same thing on how you're doing the division. Don't assume it's all capital gains unless you are actually selling your stock or your LLC directly as opposed to the assets. Don't ignore state taxes. Some of these strategies work to help with state taxes, some don't. Some states honor installment sales, some don't. So you need to make sure you're not just doing federal planning, but if you have state capital gains taxes or state income taxes, and some states have one and not the other, you need to make sure that you are planning for the state as well as the federal. This is a situation where the terms of the deal tend to be much more important than the dollar amount. You might gladly sell for 10% less, but if you get to pick how the deal gets done, you might end up with more money in your pocket at the end of the day. Well, if you want an answer customized to you, the next step is simple. Reach out to me or another attorney or CPA. You or any one of my listeners can reach out to me at agristaxadvice.com/TSP. You'll get a whole tax toolkit of tips and ways to save money on your taxes, and you'll get a chance to schedule a free call to see if I can help you. Have a great day, everyone.
I will add nothing to Matt's masterful coverage of that one, especially based on only knowing so much about the individual situation. As much as I've built business in my life, I haven't really had this problem to a large degree in any way that's made me really dig into how to solve it. But yeah, there is something though for the installment. That's something that has to be figured out, and you have to know why you're doing it. But it was the first thing I thought of, but he covered it, so I'll let it go. And we'll go on. We're going to talk about cast iron with Ken Daniels and just some advice in general on using cast iron, but also should you mill it, should you sand it down, get rid of the little bumps. Most modern cast iron is not smooth at all. It has all those little prints from the sand. I'm interested to hear what Ken says about this one. A lot of these I pre-screen. This one I'm going to listen to as we put it together, so I really don't know what Ken has to say about this. I only listened to like the first minute of it, so let's go ahead and listen together.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from JQ in England. He just ordered a 12-inch large skillet. He's moving from enameled La Crusette to a bared cast iron because he wants versatility. He's asking whether he should sand down the factory texture and what grit to use if he does, and what fat is best for seasoning without seed oils or soy. Now, JQ, I'll tell you something honestly. I cook with cast iron, but I realized I didn't quite understand the process of the metal and seasoning. I've been taught good practices by some really great chefs, but I've never really learned why. So you guys know me, time to go in and learn something new. So I called a close friend of mine who forges metal locally. I spent some time with him learning about metal and honestly getting way too hot, way too close to that damn forge. But I cherish my cast iron, so I wanted to understand it better instead of repeating that same internet bullshit. So, modern lodge skillets are sand cast gray iron. These pans have slightly pebbled texture. It's from the mold used in the casting. Vintage pans were often machined and milled after casting, which is why they feel smoother. But the base material is still gray cast iron, typically containing about 2 to 4% carbon, which I learned that from this guy. That carbon forms graphite flakes inside this iron network matrix, and those flakes are what give the cast iron its heat retention and stability. But they're also why the cast iron is so brittle and compared to forged steel. When you sand the cooking surface, you're changing the surface topography. You're knocking down these peaks and leveling these valleys that were created by the casting. I kind of come to think of it, cast iron is kind of like a good English muffin. You've got tons of nooks and crannies. You're from England. I think you can relate to that. Here's where it gets interesting. That texture actually helps the seasoning adhere. Those microscopic valleys give these polymerized fats something to grip. Once that seasoning builds properly, performance differences between textured and polished pans shrink dramatically. Early sticking issues usually are heat management problems, not surface problems. Now, JQ, can you sand it? Yes, if you want to. So this is what I've been told. If you want to go that route, you choose coarse enough to level the surface, somewhere around 60 to 80 grit. Then you step up gradually to 120 and 220. I would personally stop around 220 and maybe 320 at the most. This is all advice given from a blacksmith. Anything finer and it's actually harder to get a good seasoning. But understand what you're doing. You're stripping away factory seasoning entirely and committing to rebuild it from raw iron. And if you have the equipment at home and you want to have some fun, go for it. But most people don't need to sand their lodge. You can use a factory seasoning and just build on it. And what's more important is heat control and proper seasoning technique. Seasoning is not oil soaking into iron. After more studying, I've learned that seasoning is something called polymerization. And when fat or oil is heated past its smoking point in very thin layers, the triglycerides break apart and reorganize into these long chain polymers. It's complicated, right? But those polymers bond to the iron surface and to each other, and they form this super hard coating. It's not grease. This is why thin layers matter. If the oil is too thick, it doesn't polymerize evenly. And if it really becomes sticky. And if the temperature is too low, this reaction doesn't complete. Proper seasoning happens above the smoke point of the fat, which is usually about 450 to 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, JQ mentions he doesn't want seed oils or soy, and that's perfectly reasonable. Beef tallow works well. It produces a durable coating when applied thinly and heated properly. Pork lard, especially clean leaf lard, has been used historically for generations with cast iron and remains a reliable choice. These traditional animal fats build strong foundational layers. JQ, these are my favorite two primary fats to get my base seasoning. Now, let's talk about oils because they have a place here. Per your request, we will avoid seed oils. If you do choose to use oils, the key factor is smoke point and stability. Oils that polymerize well tend to have a high smoke point and a balanced fatty acid profile. So avocado oil is my favorite choice, provided it's applied in super thin coats and heated well past their smoke point. I've personally used peanut oil, which is great, but allergies do need to be considered, not just because your household, but for anyone that you might cook for in the future. You can use coconut oil too, but it does have a lingering flavor, so beware. But for me personally, it's either lard or tallow. But the method remains straightforward. Apply a thin layer of fat or oil, then wipe it back until it looks almost nearly dry. I make sure I rub the edges of the inside of the pan too. Then I place the skillet upside down on the rack in a 450 degree oven for about an hour. There are people that say that you need to layer it with foil. If you need to layer foil because of the dripping, you have put too much oil or fat into it and you need to wipe it out. I just let it cool slowly after it's done in the oven. Repeat as needed. What's needed? For me, it's about 3 to 4 times. I take a good Sunday, I get up, and I just make it a day. This effort is worth it. If you sand it to raw iron, I plan on more cycles to build a stable base. And if you left the factory surface intact, maybe 1 to 2 will reinforce those coats, but it's your call. Now, let's talk about fire. Gray cast iron handles high heat extremely well because of its density and carbon structure. That's why your lodge will thrive over open flame in a way that your enameled cast iron cannot. It not only handles high heat, it will hold that heat for a very long time. Using this in open flame will allow you to regulate how hot the pan gets by moving the pan off the heat, but it will still remain hot for a long time. Tossing it in the fire and leaving it there might not be the best, but to be honest, I've done some crazy thing with my Dutch oven, and it's still one of my workhorse pans. If the seasoning burns off, you reapply. Bare iron is renewable. Within reasoning, it's very forgiving. So, JQ, after going deeper into this than I expected, talking to a damn blacksmith, revisiting the science, and cross-checking everything that I was going to tell you here, here's my grounded conclusion. I would leave the factory texture unless you genuinely want the project. Use tallow, lard, or stable oil in thin layers, heat with intention, maintain properly, and understand that your skillet improves not because you modify it, because you use it consistently. Anyway, keep those questions coming in. As always, you can find me at BloodSugarChef.com. Until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
I'll give two quick little ads here. Number one, if you really just want completely milled, totally smooth cast iron to work with, there is a company that I came across on Facebook called Lancaster Cast Iron, and they're using Lodge, but they have the equipment to do this professionally, and you can buy a skillet completely milled down. You can have it milled only where the food goes, or you can have it milled elsewhere, and it costs less if you only mill where the food goes. I find this unnecessary. I have some old school like Griswolds that were milled back in the day. They're 100 years old and they're fine. And I have some lodges that were, you know, newer ones that have a little pitting and stuff, and you get a good coating on them, and they're just fine, and you have no sticking problems whatsoever. I agree with Ken. I don't see much of a performance difference once the seasoning's done. I think there is a performance difference as the seasoning is being applied. So it's, do you have the patience? The milled pans, though, cost a lot of money, and you can just buy, you know, pans that are made by the manufacturer already milled for almost the same money. You won't save much by using, but it's a small business and it fills a want. And if that's what you want, that's what you want. And I like giving small businesses a leg up. So again, they're called Lancaster cast iron, milled cast iron pans. And there's a lot of options there. But I'm just going to throw this out again, as I've said many times over the years. I pretty much have like an amicable divorce with cast iron is the way I describe it. Like, we still get along. We still do things from time to time. Like, you know, a married couple that has an amicable divorce, like they'll get together and like take the kids trick-or-treating, and they can be nice to each other and move on with their lives. But then they still have some commonality, and sometimes that they do some things together and they're friendly with each other. That's ideal if you're going to have the non-ideal world of a divorce, right? So that's kind of how I feel with cast iron. I've moved on to carbon steel. And I actually really like the carbon steel pans that Lodge makes. But I found another company, a German company called Merton & Stork, and I brought these products to you a while ago, and I probably need to run that product again. But I have a link in the show notes to them as well today. And this is a incredibly well-made pan. It costs about the same as a carbon steel pan from Lodge. The sides are higher. The surface is a little bit bigger because of the way the sides are designed on it. It's much more lightweight, obviously, than a cast iron pan, so it heats up faster, but it has still plenty of heat retention. Where cast iron excels is where the long-duration heat retention is desirable. But the weight you give up for it is the other side of it, right? So I really recommend you consider all the options and then do what works best for you. In my experience, having been like a foodie type home cook for 30 years or more, right? Really, it's almost my whole life. But doing it at an elevated level, I'd give myself about 30 years on it. I've been through all of it. And at the end of the day, I have become a huge fan of carbon steel for a variety of reasons. Do with that as you will. Now let's talk about a pup that wants to paw and how do we deal with it?
Hello everyone, this is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another expert counsel segment. And today's question is from Brandon. And Brandon has about a 6-month-old puppy, and he's doing okay in his training, but he's been pawing at them a lot. And if you know anything about puppies, they have sharp little claws on their paws, and when they do that, they can kind of scratch your hands and arms up. It also gets pretty annoying, and what they don't want is the dog to get fully grown and to be pawing and scratching at them, trying to get their attention and stuff like that. So this is a pretty common problem to have with a puppy, and what we use to correct this behavior is a command called off. Now, typically what happens in these situations is the dog will paw at you at kind of repetitious times, right? They want your attention, or you just got home from work, or you just came in from outside, or whenever you're doing various different things, maybe you just lean over and they're on the ground, and whenever you lean over towards them, they jump up and start kind of pawing at your arms. And like, I'm working puppies right now, I've got scabs and scratches all over my hands from little puppies doing this. And depending on how you're training and what you want to do in the future, you may want to stop this behavior earlier, or you may want to wait and get it, you know, let some other things happen first before I worry about this behavior, because maybe I want my dogs to use their paws or to bite or things like that, and I don't want to discourage that too early. But for most people, you want to get rid of this type of behavior pretty quickly. So, because this is usually happening in a situation where it's pretty repetitious, you can anticipate when it's going to happen. What I want to do is start using the off command. Now, I'm going to need some way to correct this dog. Okay, I can correct them with a prong collar. I can correct them by kind of swatting at their snout. I don't really encourage that. I don't like actually using your hands to swat at the dog. It creates some other behaviors that can be problematic, but that's an option. You can use an e-collar. You can also just use a very chastising verbal tone and maybe a pop on a flat collar, so just their normal collar they're wearing, just a pop on the lead with a very chastising verbal tone. Depending on your dog's mannerisms and behavior, any of these might work. You have to figure out which one is going to be enough of a correction that it gets the behavior to stop, right? So I have to have some way to correct the dog in these situations. And then before I do a behavior that I know typically is going to create this problem, I'm going to tell the dog off. And so when I go out to feed my dogs, they're often very excited. They're jumping up and they like to put their paws on us, right? So before I walk into their area, I tell them off. And then I step into their area. Now, if they jump up and put their paws on me, there's a couple things I can do. If this is a jumping up issue, I will use my knee and I will bump them in the chest when they're up on their hind legs, right? I will bump them in their chest. This oftentimes knocks them over, which is fine. And I tell them, fooey that, off. Or whatever your verbal correction is. No, off. Right? Whatever your verbal correction is, fooey or no or whatever, whatever your verbal correction you use with your dog, you do that and then you reinforce the command, off. Now, here's the key. When they don't jump up, right? Because you might have to do this 2 or 3 times. They jump up, off. They jump up, fooey, off. They jump up, fooey, off. And each time I'm getting a little harder with my corrections, and then they come running up to me still all excited, but they keep their paws on the ground. Right? And they're all excited, so their paws are kind of moving, but they're on the ground and they're like, I really want you to pet me, but I'm not going to put my paws up. That's the moment that I need to praise the dog. I need to let them know, yes, that's what I want you to do. So when they keep their paws on the ground and I praise them, oh, good off, and I give them some pets on the head and I let them know they're doing a good job. Now, sometimes when you're doing this, because it's a habit for them, right, they'll start to bring their paws up. So as soon as that happens, I take my hands away. And usually I put my hands up where they can't reach me, fooey it off. They put their paws back on the ground, good off, good off. They put a ball on me, fooey that. So when you're praising, sometimes the excitement of the praise will cause them to use their paw again. As soon as that happens, hands come off the dog, verbal correction, wait for them to stop using their paws, and then come back and pet them again. Now, if I do this 2 or 3 times and they keep using their paws, then I'm going to correct again. So for us, we typically use prong collars. I'm going to grab the lead that I have that's on the collar. I'm going to pop them. I'm going to say, fooey that, off. And then they'll be a little bit in shock, and they'll be like, oh, okay. And then I'll pet them again. Oh, good off. So I want them to know I'm happy with them when they're not putting their paws on me, and I want to correct them when they do put their paws on me. But most people make the error of waiting until the paws are up there and then trying to do something about it, right? So when I know my dog is having this issue and I walk in and I go off and they don't jump on me, I'm going to go, good off, and I'm going to give them a little pat on the head. I'm not going to get too excited typically because I don't want to create a problem when there wasn't one, but I want them to know, good job, you did great, good off, good off. Maybe I'm putting their food down for them, or maybe I want to come down and pet them. Maybe I'm trying to put a lead on them to take them outside. Lots of different things we could be doing when we get close to the dog and they start to get excited. It's not unusual for a young dog to get excited when you get down close to them, but we need to make sure that the behaviors that they're doing match what we accept, right? So I don't want them mouthing at me and putting their mouth all over my hands or my arms. I don't want them biting at my clothes unless I'm going to be doing a protection dog, and then I do want them biting at my clothes until I tell them to stop. I don't want them scratching me with their little paws. So anytime they start to do those behaviors, I tell them off or leave it. You could also use leave it in these situations. Leave it is more in our vocabulary for biting when they're not supposed to. Off is for bringing their paws up when they're not supposed to. Off means put your paws on the ground, stay on the ground, don't get up on me, get off of me, right? And so that's how we treat that situation. That's how we take care of it. If you have a specific detail or a specific thing that they're doing that you're having a problem with, or how do I do the specific behavior in this situation, you can send that message to me. You could text me 813-836-9244, or you could email me fortresscanine@gmail.com and let me know, and I'll do another video for you to address a specific situation. But in general, that's how we handle any kind of biting or pawing at us when we're training our puppies. So I hope that's been helpful for you. If you want a lot more information on how we train our dogs, and if you want to train your dog the way we train ours, you can check out Canine Academy by going to The Survival Podcast and click on the Canine Academy banner so that Jack gets credit for it there. We have the basics course, which is just your basic obedience commands. We have an intermediate course, which builds your bond, gives your dog a lot more capabilities, and sets them up for advanced training if you want to go there later on. And we have our advanced training, which covers everything from tracking to off-lead obedience, and it even gets a little bit into some protection work, although we don't teach you how to do bite work in that particular video. So you can check that out at Canine Academy. And if you're interested in getting a fully trained dog or a working line puppy, check out fortresscanine.com. You can also text me at that number I just gave you. You can click on the consult form on the website, and we will reach back out to you. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So my only add here is, I've learned a lot from Joel over the years, but the one thing I haven't adopted mostly is his German commands, you know, seats and plex and stuff like that. I've stuck to the commands that I use, and part of that was when I brought Bell and he did some co-training with me and all that. I really didn't want different commands for different dogs. So I kept what I have. Like when I want my dogs are out and about and I want them to go to the house, I say literally just house. And they go to the door, right? But what I picked up from him, here's the two things I really picked up in my language. Good skill set, right? Good behavior. Don't say good girl or good dog or good boy, right? Now you can use those terms in other ways, like just telling the dog they're a good boy or a good girl, makes them happy. But when you're asking them to do something and they do the thing and I say house and the dog goes to the door, good house. Okay, what you're doing with that is you're building up this emotional, spiritual, verbal communication relationship with that dog, and that dog, if it's if it's well cared for and it really sees you as its leader, then that praise becomes incredibly valuable. So praising the command, right, which he's always teaching you. But the one word I've picked up from him in the training is phooey. And I don't know what it is about that word. But if you can get that dog to where it really wants to please you, and it knows that phooey means that you are displeased, and the word means shame in German, it has a different connotation than no or bad. It's very hard to say bad and sound compassionate. There's something about the word, and the connotation is entirely negative. You are bad, not your behavior is bad. And I don't mean the dog understands it directly. It's something about the way we present ourselves to the dog. They are very energetic in their ability to perceive what's coming from us, right? Or no. Well, what is that means? No what? Phooey. It can be harsh, phooey, right? It can be soft, phooey, but it means the same thing. And as I learned to work with that, because that was something new to me, as I said, I think last week we were talking about this, if If Bell does something I don't want, I go, phooey that. It's like, oh my God. Oh, the sulk and the come over and like, oh, I didn't mean it. And like, is it going to be okay? And you don't have to be harsh. And that is really powerful. Now, I don't know that you're going to get there at the time you're trying to solve this problem because it takes time for that dog to mature into that role. But the time to start any conditioning and behavior is as early as possible in the relationship with the animal. So I wanted to add that to it there for you. And I'll just say, like, one of the other things I've learned in working with that technique is we always say with physical correction, whether it's an electric shock or popping a prong collar or for people that do the swat to the nose or whatever, which I don't like that either. Or in my training, a lot of times I will actually put the dog on the ground with my hand on its throat. I don't like to talk about that because you really have to know the dog, know what you're doing, and you really have to start early. If you have a dog that's even 8-9 months old and you've never done that and you do that, you might get your arm bit. So don't do it because I do it, right? But whatever the correction is, everybody understands. Use as little as necessary, the minimum required to get the result. Don't jerk the dog 5 feet off the ground with the prong collar when it weighs 10 pounds when a little tiny pop would have done it, right? You got to do that with your voice. So if phooey is enough, if just phooey, if just that results in an immediate kind of like, oh, I did wrong, you don't need to say it again, and you don't need to say it loud or aggressively. And so if you say phooey and it doesn't work, then it's phooey, right? But don't, and I'm going to say, careful how long I say it. I'll go out there and the dog will be having her tail between her legs. But if you can get that result with minimum, then do it with minimum because it's going to be more effective. And it does less to damage your trust relationship with your dog. The dog doesn't need to be afraid of you unless it really needs to be afraid of you. And I'll leave it at that for now. Let's talk about this other thing, though. I predict in the next year or two, a huge explosion, like a second explosion in the homesteading movement. Because I think we all agree we had one, and it began kind of right about the time I started the show. People were starting to, that's why I did it, the survival podcast, right? People were starting to pay attention and realize how fragile a lot of our systems were. And I think it really got like a lot of backyard gardens and stuff started up under COVID, but people didn't really know what they were doing. They were home, they had some stimmy money, and like, oh, we'll put a garden in, and it was what it was, and it was a little blip on the radar in total. But people follow incentives, right? I'll quote Charlie Munger here for you, and here's what he said about incentives. He said, never, ever think about something else when you should be thinking about the power of incentives. And so, you know, Munger would often be commentating on economics, but he'd also be commentating on things that were politically motivated. And what he was trying to point out with that is, look, there's a lot of times that we think we're talking about, like, changing a policy or changing a person or changing a law. But if we don't address the actual incentive, then we don't get any change, any result from it at all. We might paint it might look a little different, but it's the same output. So we know people are conditioned to follow incentives. And what the incentive right now is, I don't want to spend so damn much money on my food. And there's another incentive that more and more people are waking up to how unhealthy our diets are. All right? I think that's obvious, too. I think that if the changes that RFK made to the food pyramid, for instance, basically turn it upside down, was really, other than the people that shriek about everything and anything, right, especially if it's even Trump adjacent, other than those people, was broadly well received. I don't think that would have happened 20 years ago when no one even thought of Donald Trump really being president. It's just like a, oh, it could happen someday thing, right? You know, we'd be going back to what Bush would be. Bush the first would be president back in 2006. I don't think that there would have been the lack of freaking out and backlash over it. And the lack, I think people in general are like, yeah, we all know that now, even if we're not doing it. So I think people want to eat non-refined foods, non-highly processed foods, non-junk foods, and maybe not everybody, but a hell of a lot more people than that would have been the case, you know, again, 20 years ago. So if you combine that, now what are my incentives? My incentives are I want better quality food, and I don't have enough money to buy better quality food, at least in my mind. So then the incentive becomes, I have to find a way to do this. Then we have to look at, okay, if that's the broad incentive, and I think this is good. I'm doing this segment today. See what else you can apply it to, because it spells business opportunities, right? And if you're political, it spells how you make good political change. You think these through. So then, of the people that are following this incentive, where are most of them? How are they currently living? Well, you can divide how people live into groups. Inner city, very high density, not much opportunity for them to do anything. Renters, very limited opportunity to do anything. So those two groups, I'm not saying they're bad or not good or anything negative. I'm just saying, like, in analyzing the macro trend based on the incentive, you really don't have anything for them. Not enough to move the needle. Yes, some people rent a house and they have a garden. Okay, sure. That's the unicorn, right? Most people won't invest in real infrastructure in property that somebody else owns unless it's for a business. Incentives, right? What is my incentive to do this? I'm going to upgrade the electrical wiring in this shop that I lease, but it's so I can run $500,000 a year business. I'm following that incentive. I'm going to put in $1,000, $10,000, $5,000, $2,000 worth of infrastructure in this backyard of this house that somebody could throw me out of or raise my rent to where I can't afford it next year. I got to grow a lot of freaking lettuce before that pays itself off. You see the incentive there. So that brings us to the next block. The people that own a home. Now, most people that own a home in America that's not in the super high density, like it's not like a condo unit in an urban environment, they own a suburban home. They own a home with somewhere between 0.1 and 0.25, 0.35 acres. Generally speaking, in most, again, there's always to the trend, right? Most instances, the front yard is relatively small compared to the backyard. Corner lots, you know, things change that, but that's usually what you are. And the corner lot usually is bigger anymore. The back of the pat, what do you call them? God, what are they called? Good Lord, cul-de-sac, right? The cul-de-sac, usually houses on cul-de-sacs have pretty large backyards. So, you know, some number of all subdivisions are like that. So there's land to work with there. There's not many people relative to the total number of homeowners that are sitting on acreage. You know, even if you go down to small acreage like mine of 3 acres, we are the vast minority of people. The other side of it is most people that are on acreage are either in the woods and they kind of take that approach, or they already have homesteading going on. So how much room is there for homesteading growth in those spaces? And there's some. People are taking over and expanding, or like there never was, and they're establishing or they're building new on acreage, but it's the smaller piece. The majority of the people that exist within the macro trend to follow the incentive of better quality food for less money live in 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom houses on 0.1 to 0.4 to 5 acres. And I should say 2 to 5-bedroom houses and put a range in it, right? That's what they are. So there's an incentive in play, and there's a large body of people that are willing, or at least have the potential to follow that incentive. And if as little as 10% follow the incentive, then it is a massive expansion in the existing base of people that do this already. And when we think homestead, we tend to think the extreme version, like the ultimate in urban homesteading that anybody can think of back in the day, back about the time we started the show, had been the DeVayas family. I don't know what they're doing now since their patriarch died. But, you know, these were people that were growing huge amounts of food on like a 0.2 acre lot in California in all raised beds. But that wasn't a homestead. I mean, they tried to market it that way, but it was a business. That was a market garden business. They made almost all their money selling greens to restaurants. And the only way you can work at that scale and with that much time in is for it to be making you money. It has to be a business. Nobody could eat that much of what they were growing most of as a single family. Even if you're Patrick Warman with like 9,000 kids, like that's just a lot of lettuce. So when we say homestead here, instead of thinking like the full-on thing, think about the person that has a few garden beds, especially around the periphery, and you maximize that microclimate if you've got 3 fence lines that you can work with. and you can do small beds that are raised up so people that have dogs don't have their dogs destroy their gardens. You throw in some sort of protein production, whether it's the small four-chicken backyard coop, or it's the quail stack, or it's the rabbit stack, or some combination thereof. You throw in some basic composting capabilities like my mini bioreactor that I invented before I knew it was a bioreactor, made out of some garbage cans, a worm farm, black soldier flies, harvesting waste streams like we talked about last week from work, break rooms, and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, you get mushroom growing when your shaded areas in your backyard, even if it's only seasonal, and even if it's only fast-producing things like oysters. Like, there's so much that you can do on those small lots. And I've talked about the small lot advantage in the past in that you can irrigate everything. In fact, you might buy a property somewhere that already has a sprinkler system in it. When you put your gardens in, all you have to do is careful you don't damage it, and you can have an irrigated garden from an existing system. Or you can extend off of a supply line in that system, right? But the other thing is, since you're only cultivating so much soil, you can do very intensive soil management. If you start adding things to it, like what we now know about bioreactors, and if you've got somebody that's worm composting, and for the stuff beyond what the worms can do, maybe doing some garbage can bioreactors, and you add that with some biochar into backyard level gardening and a few fruit trees, you know, maybe three or four fruit trees and some things like some blackberry or other cane fruits like raspberry, the amount of food that can be produced with a low input of labor, like a hobby input of labor, so that, you know, now that we only have like a small number of gardens, like my buddy Thad, who's finishing up his military career right now, hopefully he'll be retired in about 2 years. He just put in a really nice, kind of basically a long keyhole style garden. I should put that up if he says it's okay so y'all can see it. But it's just one fence line. But the whole fence line. And it's all automated irrigation. Well, if that is focused on, and all you do now is focus on improving that soil and the raised beds, and you brought it in so you're not dealing with grass running in there or something like that. Weeding is like you go out there every couple, 3 days and just go peep, 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 and you're done. And you just keep enhancing that soil and its productivity. And over time, you figure out what you want and what you like, and then you grow that only. The incentive is very strong to do this, and I think the opportunity in that incentive is to be the person that develops the best methodology, like four or five design bases that work really well in your region, and the consulting business there is unlimited if people learn how to sell and market, that is. It is unlimited because I just want you to, you know, if you live in any kind of area that has a lot of suburbs, that means you have to be near a large urban area that has the suburbs and the beltway. Pull up Google, go to satellite view, and start looking at how many prospects there are. And if you crack the nut of how do I present this to people that tracks with the incentive that they wish to follow, if you want to be a master salesperson, put something that matches the incentive they didn't know they have in front of them, and then once it's there where they can see it, help them connect the dots back to the underlying incentive. And you can move them forward very, very easily. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there. You know, aquatics, backyard aquatics, small pond systems, things like that. Don't go overboard with it. Don't do what I've done because it takes too much maintenance. But being really smart about how to integrate these things. Things like hydroponic towers that can be moved so that they're outside all summer long, but maybe they can move inside with some lighting in the winter. Now you've got a product to add into your design offering. There's a lot of opportunities here. And then as you're building this up, if you there's a lot of ways then you can cross-network that I won't get into now. Maybe we should do a whole show on this again very, very soon. Anyway, with that, we've wrapped up another week. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I want to hear from you. Do you think we're on the cusp of another big, I'm not talking about explosion, everybody's going to do it. I think it's dumb, right? But like a clear and obvious uptick in the number of people that are producing their own food from their own backyard, and specifically in that suburban, or am I crazy? You think you just, Jack, you just believe too much in people or something. I don't know. one way or another, I'd like to hear from you on that. Would you like a show on it? I also want to remind you guys that sent in a request to edit my books. If you should have gotten a response by now. And that response was either thanks but no thanks, or you're a finalist and here's some questions to answer. I'm going to sit down probably Sunday morning, and I'm going to go through all the answers that I have back by then and pick somebody. I really, as I said yesterday, don't like telling people no to this, but I can only take one. So I have to make a decision. So I'm going to make a scoring methodology that is completely neutral. And when I go through and read the answers, I'm going to instinctively give a score for each answer and then see who scores the highest. Maybe take the top two and actually dig deeper and look a little harder. And then I just have to make a call at that point. So thank you all that applied. And again, there were over 30. I think it was 33 people applied. And I think 8 people made the finals. And that was just raw, dirty down cutting, the way you have to be when you're evaluating a lot of candidates. But I appreciate everybody that asked, and I hope that everybody got an answer. If you sent something, you didn't get an answer, you can send something today, TSPC in the subject line. And if you otherwise do a search for Spearco in your spam box. There's probably not a lot of them other than me. With that, take care, guys. I appreciate you. Remember to check out our items of the day this week. They are the Olatin's titanium scalpel and the 24-cell nursery trays with the 3-inch pots. If you have not yet picked up a copy of my first book, Laws of Life, please consider doing so. You can find that on Amazon. Just search for Laws of Life and you should be able to find it, or Laws of Life Spirico, and you definitely will. And always, if you start your online shopping at tspaz.com, you'll help us out no matter what you buy. And I will catch you guys next week with another episode.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.